psychics all agree that the telephone company will have a brand new service that lets you talk to the dead.
Hello?
Try something. Ready for this?
Welcome to Wound, Blight, and Slime, the podcast where three brothers dissect, decapitate, and disembowel the classic series, The Twilight Zone, three episodes at a time.
What do you think? Was that a decent keeper?
I liked it. That was a good one.
I practiced in the shower today. Yeah, this is Sound, Sight, and Mind, and I am Ken Andrade, joined by my brothers, Steve Andrade.
Hello.
And Chris Andrade.
Hiya.
And we are deep in spooky season, the most wonderful time of the year. Mm-hmm. So we thought we'd get to some of the spookier episodes of Twilight Zone on this episode. Some stuff with a little ghosty action in it, which is kind of my sweet spot for the series. But let's jump right in. We got two episodes in this batch which are pretty thematically similar, so we're gonna do those two first because I think they're good companion pieces. So first we're gonna start off talking about the episode Long Distance Call, which is from season 2, episode 22, and this is one of the infamous shot on video episodes.
But
maybe it doesn't work out so bad in this one. I don't know. We'll get to that. But this episode's written by Charles Beaumont and Bill Idelson, directed by James Sheldon. And it stars Bill Mummy as our child actor. He's a Twilight Zone vet. I think he did 4 episodes. Also stars Lily Darvis, Philip Abbott, Patricia Smith. Music in this episode, I believe, is all stock music. But let's get into it. The episode starts off at a birthday party for our young Billy. And Billy's dad, Chris, is leading his mother, so Billy's grandmother, down for the party. And you could tell right away that she's very frail. She's very ill. But she would not miss her grandson's birthday for anything. She clearly loves her grandson more than anything else in the world. She's very doting. Almost to like an obsessive point for this boy. So she gets brought down to the party and sits there with Billy and then asks to give a little speech before he's going to blow out the candles. And she gets a little morbid with her speech. And I want to just play that clip because I think it's the perfect little picture of her character and kind of the tone of their relationship. So let's listen in on Grandma's birthday speech to her grandson, Billy.
I like to say something. Could I say something?
Sure.
My little Billy, my wonderful little boy, he gave me life again. An old woman, good for nothing no more but to complain. He held out his hands to me and made me alive.
Why are you crying, Grandma?
I don't know, my angel. Maybe because I won't be here with you for very long.
Why?
I will be away.
Where?
Nowhere, Billy. Grandma's gonna be right here next year and the year after that.
No, don't lie to him. I will be gone.
Pretty grim. But they turn it around, and Billy blows out his candles, and it's time for presents.
I love watching the reactions of the mother. Ixnay on the Ed Day and Grog.
Billy doesn't care. He just picks up a slab of cake and tucks right into it.
Yeah, he just smashes his face into it.
Yeah,
there's very knowing looks between Chris and his wife Sylvia, just kind of like, this is kind of weird. But now it's time for presents. So Grandma wants Billy to open her present. He unwraps it, and it is an old, well, I guess it's not old, is it? It is an of the time.
Yes. Mid-century telephone. Modern telephone.
Yeah, like a Bakelite telephone.
Toy telephone.
So she gives him this telephone. She says, now you can talk to Grandma whenever you want, no matter where I am. And then Grandma starts to feel a little faint, and she tells Chris, she said, I think I need to be taken upstairs. So as Chris leads her away up to her bedroom, Rod Serling comes in with his opening narration.
As must be obvious, this is a house hovered over by Mr. Death, an omnipresent player to the third and final act of every life. And it's been said, and probably rightfully so, that what follows this life is one of the unfathomable mysteries, an area of darkness which we the living reserve for the dead. Or so it is said. For in a moment, a child will try to cross that bridge which separates light and shadow. And of course, he must take the only known route, that indistinct highway, through the region we call the Twilight Zone.
So I really wanted to see the camera pan over and see Rod in the kitchen tucking into a piece of cake as he was delivering that.
Yeah, a little birthday hat askew.
To lighten the episode a bit.
That's right. So then we come back from that narration, and a doctor has visited, and he's coming down the stairs and giving that kind of knowing head shake to Chris that things are not good. Chris and Sylvia take Billy up to Grandma's bedroom. Her bedroom is lit very spookily. She looks very cadaverous in there, and they kind of warn Billy ahead of time, you know, Grandma's on all this medication, so she, you know, she might be a little out of it. She doesn't know what she's saying. So when they go bedside, there's a real awkward moment where Chris goes over and she goes, who are you? And he says, I'm Chris, I'm your son. She said, no, I have no son. He was taken from me by a woman.
That's some cold shit. I mean, I know you're dying and doped to the gills on morphine, but come on, man.
Yeah.
That's harsh.
Yeah, tough for Sylvia. But then Grandma says, very eerily, she says, Billy is my son now. And she wishes that Billy could be with her forever and that the two of them could just go away together. And with that, Grandma passes away, and Billy cries, Grandma, and he has to be taken out of the room. After this all goes down, we go to the next day, and we start to see Billy is using his telephone, and like Sylvia will catch him on the telephone, and he's sort of talking to what sounds like, you know, a friend saying, oh, what'd you have for lunch? I had this for lunch. And she says, who are you talking to? And he says, I'm talking to Grandma. And she thinks he's kind of just doing a bit. Maybe he's coping a little bit, but he says, she wants me to come stay with her. And that's when, yeah, that's when things start taking a little bit of a turn. So Chris and Sylvia have to go to the grandma's funeral. When they come home, they find out that Billy has ran out into the street and almost got hit by a car. And the neighbor who almost ran him over with the car said, yeah, he said someone told him to do it. So things
are... And the babysitter is very scared because, like, obviously, who would have told her to do it? The babysitter.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, I didn't do it. And then the father kind of passively aggressive, yeah, apparently it's nobody's fault. You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to circle back to that babysitter later.
Here's your $2 and get out.
So then Sylvia catches Billy back on the phone and he's, you know, pretending he's not talking to anybody. And he says, I'm not talking to anyone, but she knows that what he's doing. She's starting to get suspicious that something is up here. And Chris is like, he goes in privately to tell Billy, just don't do it in front of your mom. He thinks it's all a game. And he's just saying, it makes her upset. Don't do it in front of your mom. But then... in the middle of the night, Sylvia gets up and goes over to Billy's room, and she walks by his room and hears him talking on the phone again. So she bursts in and grabs the phone from him, puts him up to her ear, and freaks out. As Chris comes in, she's like, I could hear her. I could hear her breathing on the phone. And Billy runs out of the room. Billy apparently runs right out of the house and immediately falls into this pond that they have right outside the house. And they chase him out of the house, but they find him in the pond and he's unconscious. So then they have to call paramedics, and the paramedics come and they're trying to revive him, but they're saying it's not looking good. So while the paramedics are working on Billy, Sylvia's freaking out. She's saying, she took him. So Chris goes into the other room and picks up the phone and gives a very kind of passionate speech to the phone, just saying, if you're out there, he's just a boy. Let him live his life. He hasn't even lived yet. Just let him go. And after he gives his speech, all of a sudden the paramedics are like, hey, gee, he's going to be all right. He's pulling through. I don't know how, but
we're really good at our jobs.
Yeah.
Well, Wayne says, oh, we don't know, but the doctor's going to be here soon. He can give something to your wife.
Yeah, I love that.
Yeah, that's the priority. Forget the drowned kid. Get the hysterical wife under control.
Exactly.
It's 1961.
Yep.
So on that bit of good news that Billy's all right, Rod comes back in with his closing narration.
A toy telephone, an act of faith, a set of improbable circumstances all combined to probe a mystery, to fathom a depth, to send a facet of light into a dark after region, to be believed or disbelieved, depending on your frame of reference, a fact or a fantasy, a substance or a shadow, but all of it very much a part of the Twilight Zone.
So, for me, I know we generally are down on all the video episodes of Twilight Zone. This one, for me, is one of the closest ones in terms of working, because I think for one thing, the performances are very good and everything except for, I say, the drowning. I do think the pond thing is weird. And maybe if it was a filmed episode on location, they would be able to go out a little bit bigger locations and make something a little bit more of a set piece. So that part is a little awkward for me, but otherwise,
most of it kind of works as the drawing room kind of atmosphere. I agree.
Yeah.
Except there were these little technical things, like two of the cameras they use, because they're basically shooting it like a three camera show. Two of the cameras had crap on the left side of them. One of them had a little, like, at first I thought it was a boom mic, but no, it's just like there was this little diagonal block every time it went to that shot. And then the other one had like a drape hanging down it or something. So the left side of the screen, anytime it cut to that camera, had like this wavy, fuzzy, like, and it was driving me bonkers because it just ripped me right out of the thing. Like, oh, well, you take that crap off the camera. It was very strongly scripted, acted, and directed. It was, you know, it's a shame this one wasn't filmed because it did have a little bit of that like soap opera vibe to it. Although the scripting, you said Charles Beaumont and William Idelson, but apparently this was a hotly contested authorship issue because there was a guy named Maxwell Sanford who supposedly wrote it like as a spec script, and then Beaumont adapted it, and then somehow it was co-credited to Beaumont and Idelson after Idelson did some stuff. And then later on re-releases, Sanford was credited. So,
right.
Yeah, there was some debate about that.
Yeah, there's always, like, I feel like half of the whole Twilight Zone series has been contested. At least, I mean, they were, you know, threatened with letters on, like, almost every episode saying, you stole my idea.
Yeah, but this one, apparently, they agreed.
And Beaumont, too, we've talked about that before, where he, you know, was always working in tandem because of his Alzheimer's. So, you know, there was lots of things being passed back and forth. But I think Lily Darvis is awesome as the grandma. And I think just her being, I think she's Hungarian.
She's Hungarian. I have it on good authority. It's pronounced Darvash.
Oh, okay. Darvash. Right. There we go.
Yeah, she was a Hungarian actress, long stage career. She was actually a contemporary of Ladi Lenya. If anyone knows that name, you probably know
the
it.
The Ladi Lenya.
The no, Ladi Lenya. Do you know Ladi Lenya? Or you're no just idea. Being an asshole.
Yes, the latter.
Mac the Knife. Okay. She played the part of Polly Peachum in the Three Penny Opera originally, Bertolt Brecht and Kurt Weill's Three Penny Opera. So when Bobby Darin recorded Mac the Knife, instead of saying Polly Peachum, he actually said, look out, Miss Ladi Lenya and old Lucy Brown. So that's
right.
That's her immortalized in that song. But Lily Darvish actually was part of the same theater company as her, apparently.
Yeah, I thought she kicked ass, and I thought it would be so easy for a lot of this stuff to tip, especially on video when the performances seem to read bigger, like Chris's final speech, for instance. And that was a speech that was rewritten on the day, too. Serling didn't like it, so he rewrote it on the day. But I thought he did a good job delivering it where it didn't get too ham-fisted.
Yeah, it could get really like overwrought, but it didn't.
Except the line about the long pants.
Yeah.
What is the deal with the kids wearing long pants? It's like a rite of passage. The kid's wearing long pants. I saw him when he left the room. He's got, I mean, how much longer can they get? That really angered me. Of all the things to focus on.
That's costuming, then.
Personally, I did not think that the strong performances made up for the limitations set by the videotaping. I felt that there was too much telling instead of showing. Mm-hmm. The car scene, just being told about it, I thought if that had been shown, I think it would have been much more effective.
And but then you run the risk of a car scene like in I Sing the Body Electric where...
Well, I mean, obviously it has to be based on, you know, doing it competently.
Yes.
But the other thing, too, is the pond scene, apparently, and I learned this by reading in the Twilight Zone companion book, Bill Mummy has said that they filmed scenes of him floating face down in the pond, and he thought it was a lot of fun because he was a good swimmer and he was just having fun paddling around in there. But I think it was cut based on the fact that they thought the audiences might think it was too grim to actually see it. Yeah, it kind of stinks, though, because it really if you saw that visual punch of having the kid floating, it would have had much more impact than saying, oh, he's in the pond, and like, what? Huh? What?
Yeah, and
well, I think today it'd be a no-brainer, but back then that was... I wonder if standards and practices even got involved with that.
Probably.
I mean, it was still season two, so they probably were still walking on eggshells on a lot of things there. But I think that there is a really good story at the heart of it, and like you said, there's good performances, but for me, I couldn't get past the limitations that are set by the videotape, and that's happened for other episodes, too, that were videotaped, where it's like, it could have been better, but...
Yeah. I mean, what is it? Is it the lateness of the hour, the one about the android daughter?
No pain at all.
It just limits it to such a small staging area that it becomes hard. I think the best one they probably did was Night of the Meek, but they really went above and beyond, because in that episode they made sure to have a crane with the cameras.
Yeah, they had back an outdoor set. Yeah.
So it really felt more spread out, whereas until this one feels very claustrophobic again.
Right. I definitely agree with you there. I just, I think I give it a little extra credit for being so limited and so ugly looking and all those limitations and still effectively having a little bit of creep factor, which I think is, owes a lot to the grandma to the concept too, of just a kid talking to the dead grandma and her actually saying, you know, like coaxing him to kill himself, basically, to come join her.
Yeah.
It's pretty dark stuff, especially for that time, and they don't really shy away from it, which I kind of like.
No, I thought it was an effective episode, definitely. Something that has nothing of any import to do with the episode, but just in doing the research, came across this and just have to get it in there because holy crap. So Jenny Maxwell, the actress who plays Shirley the babysitter. Minor role, not a big deal. So that same year, she would be spanked on the beach by Elvis Presley in Blue Hawaii. That was the role she was most famous for. She's a wild child who's tamed by Elvis Presley by spanking her on the beach. Because, you know, again, 1961. But that's not the crazy thing. The crazy thing is that she died young because she was shot and killed in what was initially believed to be a botched robbery attempt, but which they later found out was more likely a botched inheritance plot following a messy divorce. And supposedly, like, the lawyer for her ex-husband, like, set up this thing where he was going to hire a hitman to go in and do it, but then made a deal where the husband was supposed to get shot too, but non-fatally, except, which is a really bad idea because, as it turns out, he died within a couple weeks. Like, he lived a little bit longer. But because he lived longer, everything reverted to him, but then he didn't have a will and died intestate, and it went to probate. And so, like, the people who were supposed to get the money got nothing. And it's like this whole, like, that in itself is like this whole bonkers movie plot.
It sounds like you had the best lawyers. I mean, it's a hell of a scheme.
Well, that's the thing. Christ. It's like more unbelievable than anything with it's just like grandma on the phone.
It's like a Coen Brothers movie, for
Christ's
sake.
Right, exactly. Yeah. It's I'm reading this. I'm like, no friggin' way. So, yeah, oh, Jenny man. Maxwell.
Ken, option that story.
Seriously.
Hey, what? Aren't I working on? I'm busy working on our on our reboot. What movie was I working on? My gritty reboot of shit. I have to go back and listen to our last episode. I don't have time for another project.
We're just giving you a wealth of intellectual property here, is what we're doing.
That's true.
But yeah, that was kind of crazy. The you know, a lot of the actors were, you know, kind of your standard. Did a lot of TV, did a lot of Westerns, did a lot of...
Oh, yeah. Philip Abbott, he went on to direct all of these Disney educational shorts that you can find them all on YouTube. It's all like these films where he plays kind of an old hobo uncle sort of character, and then they tie it in with whatever Disney movie they want to tie it in with, and there's some lesson. So it's like a 10-minute short. So I watched the one where there's a kid who runs away from home and then stumbles on Phil Abbott in his truck. Just, oh, you're running away. That reminds me of Mowgli. You remember Mowgli from the Jungle Book? And then they'll cut in, you know, footage of Mowgli. And so those are kind of kitschy and fun. But that seemed to be his bread and butter for a while.
Back in the day where life lessons from random hobo type people was seen as a viable means
of
education.
He's out in the road and full of wisdom. Another thing you mentioned before about his speech on the phone when Chris is trying to convince his mother to let Billy go, and the fact that they rewrote it on the day, and the original script, it was focused on Chris talking to his mother about when he was a boy and all the things that they did, and now it's his son's turn, and Rod Serling came over and talked to Charles Beaumont and William Idleson and said, it's not working, I need a rewrite on this. And so they both sat down and decided, oh, all right, so we focus again on Billy. And so that's when they took a lot of the same things and just switched it to the, you know, father talking about, like, all the things he wasn't able to do instead of the things that he himself did when he was a kid.
Yeah.
And it works so much better. I mean, reading the original script, they have that in the Twilight Zone Companion as opposed to the one that was filmed. It's like, it was definitely a huge improvement and a really good decision by Rod to fix that.
And Rod's so pleased with himself as he's writing. He never got the chance to wear long pants. Yeah, that's the stuff.
Long pants. Gotta keep those long pants in there.
Yeah, Rod's gonna rod.
Rod's gonna rod.
No, that wasn't Rod Serling. That was Beaumont and Idleson.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, Rod just told him to do it. And apparently it was a thing of the times, because I know that in one other episode, which we'll talk about at some point, I'm sure, Young Man's Fancy, the main character reminisces about his long pants.
No, it absolutely was. Like, you weren't allowed to wear long pants. Children were in short pants. It's a whole thing. And before that, even just wearing any kind of pants, because children were in more or less unisex dresses,
right?
As toddlers, like, they didn't wear trousers at all.
Until you turn 10 years old and you got your pants to go off and work at the factory.
And to work your 12-hour shift.
Yeah,
we couldn't have the little boys getting sucked into the machinery. They'd leave that to the little girls.
Right.
Well, this is taking a weird turn.
Right, okay. So back to haunted telephones. Let's move on to our next episode, our sister episode, if you will, Night Call, actually based on a Richard Matheson's short story that was called Long Distance Call originally. But this is season 5, originally supposed to be episode 9, turned into episode 19 because it aired on the, or it was supposed to air on the night of the Kennedy assassination. So got bumped for way later in the season. Directed by Jacques Tourneur, starring Gladys Cooper, who's appeared in another Twilight Zone episode, Nothing in the Dark.
She was also in Passage on the Lady Anne.
Oh, yes. Yep.
And I know in the Twilight Zone fan groups that I'm part of on Facebook, every so often somebody circulates a picture of her from like the 1918 or 1920s. And like, she was a gorgeous young actress.
Yep. She was born in 1888.
Yeah.
Had a West End and Broadway career as well as silent films.
This episode also stars Nora Marlowe and Martine Bartlett. Music, again, is all stock cues. But we're back to film, which is good, because right away this episode is all about atmosphere, and we come in on a nice dark and stormy night with crashing lightning and rain and all that good stuff. Gladys Cooper is playing an old woman named Elva Keen. And she's in her bedroom during this storm, and she's struggling to sleep. And all of a sudden, her phone rings. So she picks up the phone, and all she hears on the other end is static. No voice at all. She hangs it up, and right away, it rings again. And still, just an ominous static on the other end of the line. And Rod Serling comes in with opening narration.
Miss Elva Keen lives alone on the outskirts of London Flats, a tiny rural community in Maine. Up until now, the pattern of Miss Keen's existence has been that of lying in her bed or sitting in her wheelchair, reading books, listening to a radio, eating, napping, taking medication, and waiting for something different to happen. Miss Keen doesn't know it yet, but her period of waiting has just ended, for something different is about to happen to her, has in fact already begun to happen, via two most unaccountable telephone calls in the middle of a stormy night. Telephone calls routed directly through the Twilight Zone.
The next day, Elva's trying to figure out who was calling, so she's in touch with the phone company, and the phone company's telling her that the storm knocked down lines and made the phones all fluey. And meanwhile, Elva's housekeeper shows up at the house, and you kind of get the sense of Elva's personality. She's a little snippy. She's a little bossy, a little high strung, and is really, really amped up about these middle of the night phone calls. So while the caretaker tries to ease her mind about it and say it's probably due to the storm, and the phone company is doing the same, the calls keep happening. And this time when Elva will pick up the phone, she starts to hear kind of a creepy voice on the other end. And I got a clip of that just so you get a sense of what that sounds like.
Hello? What? Who's on the line? Who is it?
It's a little, it's like borderline silly what he, it sounds like somebody just kind of smashed their knee into the wall or something.
Wanted to hear him say, what are you wearing?
Yeah. Elva keeps bothering the phone company, trying to demand answers for who could possibly be calling. And they're saying, you know, their technicians are working on it. It's, you know, it's a mess out there because of the storm. The calls keep coming. And in the middle of the night, she gets a phone call. This time the voice on the other end actually talks and it says, "Where are you? I want to talk to you." So she's really freaked out at this point and screams into the phone, "Leave me alone." So the next day, the phone company calls her back and they say, "Oh, we've traced the fallen line. You couldn't have been getting any of these calls." And she said, "But I have getting calls and there's voices on the other end." And they say, "Miss Keen, there's no one at the other end of the line. The falling line was traced to a cemetery." Which is, big, great reveal. So Margaret, Elva's caretaker, drives her out to the cemetery and they find the phone line that was downed and it's laying across a grave. And Elva sees the name on the gravestone and she says, "Brian, it's Brian." And you find out that the grave belongs to a man who was her fiance long, long time ago when they were young. But she explains that she was just as bossy back then and bossed him around, made him do whatever she said. And she insisted on driving this one day and she lost control of the car and they, I think they hit a tree or something and Brian went through the windshield and died. And it was all her fault. So later that night, Elva just picks up the phone and tries talking into it and tries asking for Brian and, you know, thinking she can talk to him now. She doesn't have to be lonely anymore. She could talk to her Brian. And she says, like, "Speak to me, you know, say something." And he said, the voice on the other end said, "You said to leave you alone. I always do what you say." And he gets off the line, leaving her once again to be alone as she cries, you know, saying, "Brian, Brian." Alone in her bed, having once for the one last time bossed her ex-fiancé right out the door.
He came back from the dead just to stick it to her. Yeah. What a dick.
And at that point, Rod Serling comes in with his closing narration.
"According to the Bible, God created the heavens and the earth. It is man's prerogative and woman's to create their own particular and private hell. Case in point, Miss Elva Keen, who in every sense has made her own bed and now must lie in it, sadder but wiser by dint of a rather painful lesson in responsibility, transmitted from the Twilight Zone."
So this one, like I said, it starts off with atmosphere. I think it's got good atmosphere having these night calls happen in the dark of night and in the storm. And it's a, you know, a creepy thing to have a staticky phone call and no one on the other side.
But I had a different take than you did. The note I had when I was watching, I said, "Gee, with this directing style, videotape would have worked fine." That I don't think the director took advantage of the medium. I thought it felt very kind of soap opera-y. And I mean, the script lends itself to that, but even the composition of the shots and everything, it almost could have been videotaped for 90% of it.
Yeah, kind of meat and potatoes, right? Yeah, they just end up getting to go out on location to a cemetery for that one shot.
But Jacques Tournier had a long history of using atmosphere in his movies and taking very low budget movies and making them look better. Like he did the original Cat People, I Walked with the Zombie, which, you know, was created to be a schlock horror movie. It was one of the Val Lewton produced movies where they came up with the title first and were like, "Oh, I Walked with the Zombie, great." And then he comes with this very lyrical kind of mysterious movie. And the same thing with Cat People, that becomes this kind of weird musing on sexuality and
yeah, that was a like classic
and like psychotic breaks and stuff. I feel like it didn't translate all the way in here. There were some parts of it I thought that really picked up on that same kind of vibe. I thought it could have been pushed a little further.
Yeah.
And I am also more of a fan of the original story that Matheson wrote.
Same. Yeah.
Which is more of a horror story rather than this kind of like, oh, tragic twist.
Right. We never find out in Matheson's story who the caller is.
And the last thing the caller says is, "I'm coming."
I'll be right over.
Yeah. Which is far more ominous.
Yeah, right. That sucks. That's if you're Elva Keen, oh shit.
But which that is be funny a great because then, horror story.
Yeah. But then I get like fitting into the world of the Twilight Zone and what they tend to do. I mean, Matheson went on record to say he prefers this ending because the short story just kind of is what it is. But when you're doing like a character study, he thought this was a better arc to have a whole character study for Elva Keen.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it hasn't been confirmed, but they think that Matheson may have been influenced by an old urban legend that came from back when there was panic about being buried alive and stuff. Some rich people supposedly had, it turns out it wasn't actually true in most cases, but had phones installed in their crypts, in their coffins, things like that. And so there was a story that, you know, the call is coming from inside the coffin kind of thing.
It's like the updated bell.
Right.
Like bell coming out of the ground.
And so I think what Matheson felt, you know, was that, you know, it elevates it beyond just the kind of urban legend shot ghost story to give it, you know, a little more psychological twist to it.
Yeah, which I can appreciate. But then I guess just from a viewing experience, I sort of start off really into the episode and into the vibe and into the promise of it. And then when they get to the cemetery, it all is like a little too cute. For me, like it's almost like you add a trombone, you know, one of those famous trombone things at the end when he says, "You said leave you alone, and I do what you said."
Well, funny you should mention that, because I thought Gladys Cooper just acted the heck out of it. I thought her facial expression, everything was brilliant. But I said the stock music just undermines the effectiveness of the drama because it's all so obvious. It's a creepy cue, you know. It was just
but they did also, I noticed a lot of time, especially initially when she's getting the calls, they all kept the background music to a minimum, which I thought was very good. You heard the storm sounds and then you heard the silence and then you heard the, you know, the phone.
Right, but then the minute it pivots to, okay, it's going to be, you know, that, you know, it's a cemetery, blah, 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 you know, it's like from then on in, it just sucks. Like all the music cues leading up to the cemetery and everything, it's like there's no subtlety anymore. Whereas given the direction they were taking it, they could have just gone with more kind of, you know, dramatic strings without being horror movie.
You know, I'm just thinking of like Bernard Herrmann's score for Eye of the Beholder, some of the music cues that were used there, his score for Living Doll. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if they'd had original music, Bernard Herrmann could have provided some really great moodiness that would enhance and complement what was going on screen.
Mm-hmm.
So I agree with you there. But I don't know. I feel like we got cheated out of the... you know, if I'd never read the original story, I probably wouldn't feel as strongly. But reading the original story, I felt like we got cheated out of what it could have been a really good, really creepy Twilight Zone episode.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, it's kind of like the monkey's paw, right? Where you don't see what's on the other side of the door, but you know it's there kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, those are our two phone-related ghost stories. I don't know, like which
oddly
do you give the
specific genre?
Yeah, which do you give the edge to? Because I'm not sure. Honestly,
I'm not sure either. I'm kind of split. I feel like both of them are lacking in certain areas.
I think Night Call holds together better than, or excuse me, no, long distance call. Right, long distance call holds together a little bit better. I think just the ensemble is strong there. I think the concept holds together better because, as you said, there was that kind of bait and switch with the other one with the rewrite of the Matheson ending. I just think it feels more original. If that makes sense.
You're right. Night Call does feel like so many versions of that story have appeared in various ghost story anthologies, you know, that you could
It feels very much like it could be like that kind of urban legend type ghost story. Like
yeah, it's a scary story to tell in the dark kind of feel.
So, slap some Alvin Schwartz or Stephen Gamble illustrations on it.
Drawings,
yeah, just like a phone with those weird little dribbly ink smears on it, and there you go. Terrifying.
Well, then let's change gears completely then.
And go to the pre-telephone era.
Yeah. To our
with final. A haunted telegraph.
Tap, tap, tap.
Our final ghost story.
It spells
story.
Out boo.
No, wait, there's more. There's another B.
Our final. Can we pull it together here?
God. No.
Now I want us to write a script with the haunted telegraph that spells out naughty words.
Spells out boobs.
Boobs.
Our final ghost tale of the night is from season 3. This is episode 4, entitled The Passerby, and this is written
Passersby.
I'm sorry. Passersby.
Just to make it harder to pronounce.
Passersby.
I was corrected by Google when I went to research it, so don't feel bad. Yes. Did you mean passersby? Well, yes, I did. You smug AI bastard.
Of course, it's a persnickety title. It's written by Rod Serling.
Directed. If you didn't know that at the beginning, you would know it very shortly.
Directed by Elliot Silverstein, who also directed The Obsolete Man, one of our faves. I think it was our faves. I like it.
We like it.
This stars James Gregory and Joanne Linville, and it has original music by Fred Steiner. Some original score. Okay, so the episode opens. We see a shot of men in sort of shadow in a forest, walking along kind of a woodsy road.
One of whom is unmistakably Jamie Farr, even with his face bandage.
I was so happy to find that fact out because I clocked it when I was watching it. And then you look at trivia, it's like one of the actors is Jamie Farr. It's, knew it. Yeah.
It's funny. I happened upon that fact a while ago. I had done a painting for a show. It was an art show that was a tribute to Weird Al Yankovic, and I was doing a painting inspired by a song where Weird Al is kidnapped by aliens who look like Jamie Farr. So I'm looking up Jamie Farr, and this picture of this guy with this scarf over his nose and mouth keeps popping up, and everybody's like, that is definitely Jamie Farr in that Twilight Zone episode. I'm like, about that? And here he is. Yep. No lines, just walking on by.
That's right. And then this episode has kind of like a split opening monologue thing. So as Jamie Farr walks by, Rod Serling does his first little piece of monologue.
This road is the afterwards of the Civil War. It began at Fort Sumter, South Carolina, and ended at a place called Appomattox. It's littered with the residue of broken battles and shattered dreams.
So walking along the road, there is one particular soldier who approaches this old... old plantation house where there is a youngish woman on the porch, and he asks if he could have some of her water and rest. So he joins her in this plantation yard, and he's plucking away his git box, singing some songs, and they get to talking, and she reveals that her husband was killed in the war, and she's currently sick with a fever. And she's just been in her house watching this endless parade of soldiers walking along this road. So she and this soldier are just kind of shooting the shit and singing songs together. And then Rod Serling comes in for a second half of his narration.
In just a moment, you will enter a strange province that knows neither north nor south. A place we call the Twilight Zone.
So this young woman, who is named Lavinia, she recognizes another soldier who's walking down this road as a young man who lives in the town that she's from. And she runs up to him and she says, I thought you were killed. Oh, your wife is going to be so, so happy to see you. This is so amazing that you're alive. But he's acting really kind of strange and aloof, and he's just staring down the road and just talking about how he has to make his way down the road, and he takes his hat off and hands it to her, and she notices that the hat is in fact smeared with blood, and then he moves on. So Lavinia and this sergeant are just kind of hanging out on their porch, talking, singing songs, and it almost seems like the sergeant, they're just talking and talking. And I don't know if the sergeant is like doing chores around the place. It's very straight. They're just hanging out and chatting and monologuing. One of Lavinia's monologues being that she just wants to find herself a Yankee to get revenge for her Judd. I think his name is Judd, her husband who is killed. And just any Yankee that she finds, she just wants to shoot him and get her revenge. And then the sergeant gets kind of pissed off at her and is just, you know, like gives one of his monologues, a very surly monologue about...
Totally surly.
Yeah, just like, when is the violence going to end? The North, the South, and now Mr. Lincoln. And, you know, very, very moral grandstanding about the horrors of war. So then another soldier kind of shows up at their door, and he's all in shadow, but you can see by his dress and his hat that he's a Yankee soldier. So the sergeant goes and greets him and recognizes the guy, and he's like, oh, you helped me out. I was getting shot at, and you and your boys picked me up. And then Lavinia comes out with her shotgun, and she's like, I found myself a Yankee. And she's fires on him, but then nothing happens. The guy doesn't get shot, seems to have no effect on him. And then the sergeant kind of eerily goes, wait a minute, I remember now. You and your boys were fired upon. You took gunfire. And he holds up his lantern. And in what's kind of like what seems like a rare crossing into full horror territory for Twilight Zone, you see his face, and half of his face is all shot up and...
Yeah, his eye is gone.
Bloody, his eye is gone.
Three seasons we went a long way from not wanting to show a kid in the pond.
Yeah, they really went for it, which is kind of neat. Then that soldier then eases on down the road himself too. We fast forwarded a day, I guess, and our sergeant then decides it's time for him to get back on the road and see what's at the end of it. And Lavinia is begging him to stay. Just don't go, you know, don't go. I don't want to know what's at the end of the road. Please don't go. But he says he's got to know, and he moves on. And then who comes up the road? But it's her husband, Judd. So she just runs to him, runs to his arm. She's so happy to see him. You're home. We could stay. And Judd explains to her, no, we can't stay. This isn't our home anymore. Our home's up there. And she then has to realize that Judd did in fact die, and he explains, you died too. You died, me of gunshots, you of a fever. So she won't accept it. So Judd says, I'm going to move up the road, and I know I'll see you there when you're ready. And he goes, and Lavinia is sort of in pieces. But who comes to pick up the pieces but Abraham fucking Lincoln? He shows up.
The last casualty of the Civil War.
Yeah, he declares himself the last casualty of the Civil War, but he starts quoting Shakespeare to her and really gently urges her on that it's time for her to move on and head to the end of the road where they all must end up in the end. And Rod Serling comes in with his closing narration.
Incident on a dirt road during the month of April, the year 1865. As we've already pointed out, it's a road that won't be found on a map, but it's one of many that lead in and out of the Twilight Zone.
Kind of phoning in that closing narration this time, Rod. I have nothing new to say. We've said it before. Yes, this is the Twilight Zone.
Abraham Lincoln said everything I need to say, so I'll just wrap up and say it's the Twilight Zone, obviously.
Yeah, so, I mean, this episode, so, again, I do like that they really go for it with that one moment with the soldier's face.
That moment is very well staged, because beforehand mm-hmm. the lighting is very interesting because the mounted soldier yep. is in total shadow. It's his lines are delivered very interestingly because he's very kind of calm, which has its own eeriness to it. And then, you know, there's the reveal when they hold up the lantern and see his face. And again, it's very quick, but that, you know, probably for both censors and also just for the fact that they wanted to hide any imperfections in the makeup. But it's enough to give you that feeling and that glimpse. And like you said, it's a very different thing for Twilight Zone to go for the gore. That was usually like the outer limits.
Yeah.
Or would do something like that.
It just, it takes so long.
Yeah.
To get through, like, it, you figure out in the first 3 seconds when these guys are on the road and the atmosphere, like, okay, they're all dead.
They're all dead.
They're all dead. Yeah. They're all watching. Everybody's dead. Union, everyone's dead. It's cool. You know, and to the point where when the sergeant finally figures it out the next morning, it's like that scene in Beetlejuice. Coach, I don't think we survived that crash. You know, it's what tipped you off? You know, it's just so long getting there, and the acting is so overwrought. Oh my God, where she's hugging the column and talking about her Judd, and then play real loud for me, play real loud to drown out my own sorrows. It's like, oh, shut up.
Yeah.
And so, of course, I'm doing my research on this. So Joanne Linville, she taught acting at the Stella Adler Academy, and I just put, really? Mark Ruffalo was one of her students. And apparently was a big fan. He said she didn't theorize about great acting. She was great acting.
Well, also it seems like
not there.
Well, I think she talked about too that she played smaller roles a lot. She was often more supporting characters, and this role she was like, I got a starring role. I finally got a meaty role. So it was like, I got my chance to shine on the Twilight Zone.
But you had the combination of Serling's writing, the overwrought direction, and then the, oh God, it was just, it was a lot. I felt like I was watching some of my high school acting students who are doing the look at me, I'm acting school of acting. You know? And come on, guys. Let's get grounded here.
I mean, I think we've talked about before how, at least for me, Westerns aren't my cup of tea. I sort of am not tune out in that. And same with war episodes of Twilight Zone. And this one in particular has that kind of the stink of antebellum romanticizing of the South, just the Southern focused thing where it's like, oh, she spent so much of the episode being, there was so much beauty once. There was beauty here. This house was beautiful. This land was beautiful.
We had all the darkies to take care of it, and it was beautiful.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, this is a white-ass episode of television.
Yeah.
And even just, like, you know, aside from just the general, and it makes for, a fun line in TV, but Lincoln declaring himself, I guess I'm the last casualty of the Civil War. It's like, hey, no, you weren't, if you're going by actual casualties of war.
And let's just ignore the Reconstruction. Let's just forget about all that. That's fine.
Let's ignore all the loss of Black life. This kind of thing, we
talked about it before when we did the episode Still Valley, which was the Confederate soldiers, and we talked again about how it romanticized the noble cause of the South a little bit, you know.
Yeah.
And it's hard to swallow, especially in the 21st
century. I think there's an effort here to make sure that she's, you know, not the most sympathetic character. I mean, you know, she's the one who's still promoting the violence against the Yankees and getting called out for it and that. And the fact that Lincoln's the one who kind of delivers the final thing, although saying that a Confederate war dead would even refer to him as Mr. Lincoln is probably a bit of a stretch.
That line was tough for me. Yeah.
But also,
even Mr. Lincoln, I'm like, I don't think they would think that.
But also one of the things too is, and to that point, the dead Union soldier with the eye out, the sergeant recognizes him not just as somebody who had died, but somebody who had saved his life.
Yeah.
When he was lying on the side of the road or something on the battlefield, and he gave him water, which is
yeah, but I think
not too probable.
Right, but I think Serling was trying to, like, put himself slightly on the right side of history with all that, you know. It's like let's elevate the Union a little bit.
Right. Yeah. I mean, you could flip the script and make it an you know,
right.
A North focused thing. I think you could flip the script and do it where it's the North, and then even have a thing with a Southern soldier who helped, you know, that could all go fine, except I think in terms of at that time making television, it wouldn't have been the compelling sweeping Gone with the Wind style,
right,
monologuing about the beauty of my land and old Judd. And right. It just doesn't make for
well,
the same
and
type
it
of
also
program.
Would have if it's like, okay, all the Union soldiers walk into heaven, what the hell are the Confederates doing there too? And well, it's all, you know, it might have gone too far the other way, and oh, are we being apologists for everybody now?
Well, then I think you get into it. You get into that existential shit, and you really start asking, like, what is at the end of the road, you know? Let's hash this out.
But
you do end up instead with 30 minutes of sitting on someone's front lawn, just kind of endlessly monologuing at each other with some plucking at a Gitbox.
Yes.
In the song, what's the song?
Black is the color of my true love's hair. Good old classic folk song.
And there's some debate, I guess, as to whether that's timely or not, if it's era appropriate or if it's...
It's an old, old song. Let's see. This should be my bailiwick here. I should know this.
I think there was something about it. It's like first instance of being recorded. Maybe it was the early 1900s or something, but... You know,
well, just
I don't know.
It's recorded origins. Doesn't mean.
Yeah,
it
I don't. I don't know
around.
The origins of
this. Oh, so these words are set to two distinct melodies, one of which is traditional, and the other was written by Kentucky folk singer and composer John Jacob Niles. Niles recalled that his father thought the traditional melody was downright terrible, so he wrote a new tune, ending it in a nice modal manner. So, I think it's the John Jacob Niles version that we usually know, and I think that's the one that's used.
So is he singing like age-appropriate lyrics to a more contemporary melody?
Yeah, I believe so. I mean, it's tough to know with these folk songs because it's the Niles version was recorded in 1941. But it had been around for a long time. It probably... quite possibly had its origins in Scotland. Alan Lomax, who is a noted American musicologist, worked with Charles Seeger, Pete Seeger's dad. He figured that it was an American remake of British materials. So there's variants of it that pop up in the British Isles, like little snippets of the lyric and the original melody. But I've only ever heard that tune, and it looks like that is the John Jacob Niles tune. The other John Jacob Niles song that a lot of people know is the Appalachian Christmas song, I Wonder as I Wander, which has that same kind of modal thing going on. Okay, now I feel like I've
there you go.
Justified my credentials here.
All right.
So despite the obvious detriments of this episode, I do think it's funny that it feels like it was lifted almost whole for the movie The Others with Nicole Kidman.
Yeah.
There's that whole scene where her dead husband comes wandering down the road past the house.
Yeah.
And then she invites him in, and then he has to go on to his final reward.
Yeah, this whole episode to me, it felt very much similar to Five Characters in Search of an Exit, but I enjoy that. That one's so much weirder, obviously. But it's the same kind of thing. It's like you got your characters who are just talking at each other, trying to figure out what the hell they're all about. And then the end is the reveal. So this is the same thing, just less quirk, more hamminess, less clowns.
Well, I think that she's dead too, and that the sergeant are dead. It's like that's a little kind of minor twist. You can certainly kind of pick up on some of it, like why are they seeing them all?
Yeah,
you know, kind of thing. But you know, he is played differently enough from all the others, and that's never really explained either. Like, how come he's so much more lucid and folksy?
He was only they've all got the 1,000-yard stare. When you're mostly dead, there's still a little life.
Well, maybe. Maybe he's walking down the road and he's seeing them, but he's not quite there yet until the next morning.
He's got a blood clot that's going up his legs. He's
trying slowly working its way out.
But yeah, that never quite tracks either. But it's, like I said, it's like it's so obvious what's going on, you know, very early on. As far as, okay, it's the road, you know, it's the walk of the dead.
We should just be thankful it's not a season 4 episode that was stretched to an hour long.
God, it felt like it, though.
Yeah, sure did. Yep. Yeah, not necessarily one that I would revisit often.
Oh, now, we looked at a previous episode, I forget which one, where one character was famous for playing Ben Franklin and he wound up doing Ben Franklin in like 5,000 different projects.
So I
was like, all right, I gotta see if this guy's done Lincoln any other time. And I was looking and like, no. Oh, wait a minute. So this guy did play Lincoln once before, in a really bonkers movie called The Story of Mankind. Have you ever heard about this one? No. I have to find it and watch it, because it's got Vincent Price and Groucho Marx and a bunch of other celebrities. It's sort of a comedy, sci-fi, philosophical treatise, weird. Basically, aliens are putting mankind on trial, like has been done in countless sci-fi things. And a devil and an angel are called to be the advocates to kind of put man on trial. And so the rest of the movie is just a series of vignettes examining scenes from world history, basically. But it was done on such a cheap budget, because they basically blew the budget getting celebrities for every single vignette with the promise that they would only have to do one day of shooting and they would get paid $25,000. So it's like, so they got this like A-list cast and Z-list like resources and talent working behind the scenes. So apparently it's like a travesty of a movie, but it's like an interesting travesty of a movie. So I think this needs to be on our list. The Story of Mankind.
That sounds awesome.
But apparently he was Lincoln in that.
Well, that about does it for our spooky tales for this go around. Unless any of you got any final thoughts, or for me, it's a long distance call for the win out of the three, I think.
Yeah, I think for me, it's both the phone ones are kind of neck and neck, and the passerby is left mercifully behind in the dust.
Yeah.
Passers-by, sorry. Sorry.
Passers. Passers. So next time we get together, moving away from the spooky stuff, where are we going to visit next?
I think we're going to go back to some sci-fi. Feel like we haven't really talked about sci-fi stuff in a while, so we're going to do an episode that I think we dubbed Time Twisters Part 1, because if there's one thing that Twilight Zone loved to do, it was time travel episodes. So the one the three that we're going to be talking about are, I believe, the Rip Van Winkle Caper, 100 Yards Over the Rim, and the Odyssey of Flight 33, or
33?
33. The Odyssey of some flight. 33. You know the one. They fly, and there's an Odyssey.
Fly. There's about a dozen people in the cockpit.
Yeah, it's great. So, yeah, some time travel, classic sci-fi goodness to talk about next time.
Nice. All right, well, if you have any thoughts or episodes you want to hear about, you can hit us up at ssmpodcast@gmail.com or follow us on Instagram. Hopefully you are subscribed either on Apple Podcasts or Spotify now. Leave us a review. That helps always. And until next time, we hope you have a very spooky Halloween.
Don't pick up the phone. Don't pick up the phone.
Aww. Oh. That's my Brian.
That's spot on.
All right, see you next time.
See you next time.